Thank you, sir.
All right, Mr. Stone.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Eric Stone for appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal, if I may.
All right, you'll have to watch the lights and keep up with your own time.
I will do that, Your Honor, and thank you. The St. Louis County Police Department has a formal written policy allowing its officers, in order to further their investigations, to issue what both sides concede are the equivalent of arrest warrants without the approval of a detached and neutral magistrate. That policy violates the Fourth Amendment, and the county is liable under Monell, even if each wanted is supported by probable cause, and even if this court were to find that the individual officers are entitled to immunity.
Are they arrest warrants, or are they the equivalent of Old West wanted posters?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. They are the functional equivalent of arrest warrants in that the person is taken into custody. I think the Old West wanted poster raises a question as to which of the citizenry were allowed to take people into custody at the time, and a variety of issues not presented here. I certainly take the point. But the idea behind these orders, and this is undisputed, is that where a St. Louis County police officer wants to interview a suspect, he or she can issue an order that allows any other officer, not only in St. Louis County, not only in St. Louis City, but across the border in Illinois, in several counties, and elsewhere in Missouri, to take that person into custody so that they can be questioned by the issuing officer. And I think that's actually where the wanted system runs afoul of both Gerstein and Riverside.
But those aren't these cases. These cases, there was actually suspicion that Torres and Fort Furlow had committed a criminal acts.
Yes, Your Honor, I want to parse that in a couple of different ways. It is the contention of the other side that there was probable cause. We dispute that. But even if there were, I think Your Honor is right that they were taken into custody to complete an investigation about something that didn't start from scratch. It's not as if Officer Detective Clemens woke up one morning and said, Torres, why not? She was investigating what she thought was a crime, and she wanted to speak to Mr. Torres. However, what both Gerstein and Riverside in this court's opinion in Davis teach us is that if you arrest somebody without a warrant based on probable cause, you have to then begin immediately the steps incident to arrest to bring them before a court. What Gerstein teaches us in footnote 12 is that the heart of the Fourth Amendment, I'm quoting, that's not my phrase, the heart of the Fourth Amendment is that when someone is arrested, it represents a compromise and a cooperation between the police, who develop the facts, and a judge, who decides, is that probable cause? The undisputed testimony of every witness in this case, officer, lieutenant, detective, 30B6 witness, individual witness, is that wanteds are issued as an investigatory tool so that someone can be brought down to the station house or to the Justice Center to be questioned before they decide whether to follow the steps incident to arrest to bring that person before a magistrate judge.
Well, the reason why I'm asking this and comparing it to the Old West wanted posters is I just wonder whether there's a pattern or practice of doing this for literally the entire pendency of the American nation, right? All the way back to the founding, which is to say that those post office wanted posters, I'm sure, involve taking people into custody. You see them in a nearby town, Billy the Kid or whatever. you take them into custody, you put them in the county jail overnight so that he could see a magistrate in the morning. And if that's been our pattern or practice for 200 years, why should this be any different? Why is this unconstitutional now?
I respectfully submit for at least two reasons. One, there is no record evidence that that's been the pattern in practice. The record evidence is that the only place this happens in the country is here. And in fact, the Justice Department's investigation of Ferguson said this seems to be an end run around the warrant requirement. But the other answer to that question, I think equally valid, is that most of that history is before Gerstein and before Riverside, and before the Supreme Court told us that you can't do that. So whether it may have been okay in 1812, I don't know the answer to, but I do know it's not okay now. And so the holding of the Supreme Court is that you may not take a person into custody to interrogate whether you have enough evidence. In fact, that's what happened in Riverside. Riverside, I should point out, is a Section 1983 case, just like this one, challenging the municipality's practice as to how it takes people before judges. In that issue, in that case, my recollection is it took 3 days, and the question was that too long? Missouri has a statute that it can't take longer than 24 hours, but this court has said repeatedly that that's a shield to protect defendants not a sword to say you can take people in custody and hold them for 24 hours. If you take, for example, the deceased and therefore non-appellant, Mr. Weiner, he was taken into custody, and it took the officer one question to discover he had the wrong person because the four rims of the cars wouldn't fit in the BMW 328. What this court held in Davis following on Riverside is you can't take someone into custody in order to investigate them. What the wanted system then does is makes that even worse, because in every case the appellee's cite, you're talking about an individual arrest by an individual officer who himself has probable cause. What's going on in the wanted system is that the arrests are made by people who have no idea what the basis for the arrest is. And if I am driving down the road and I don't have license plates, or my taillight doesn't work, or I'm speeding, or whatever happens, and the officers run a search on me, if there is a warrant for my arrest from Delaware, the officers serving that warrant and I as a citizen know that a judge made the assessment that is now going to cause me to be taken into some police station and held until I'm extradited. This is the only place we know of in the country where that can happen, where a police officer issues an order by which some other officer can take someone into custody so the first police officer can come question them, as opposed to so they can then be arraigned, charged, and criminally prosecuted.
Okay. The news reported this morning that the FBI has identified a person of interest in the subway shooting yesterday.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the difference? I can only assume that if a law enforcement agency encounters that person, in view of the FBI's notification that they're going to take him into custody. What's the difference in what? And you see the person of interest identification all the time.
All the time.
So what's the difference?
Exigency, Your Honor. There is no dispute that where there is a person on the run who is accused of shooting six people in a subway station, that person can be taken into custody for all of the reasons that exigency is an exception to the warrant requirement. But the record evidence in this case is that 15,000 wanteds were issued for every crime in the book, the vast majority of which don't raise questions of exigency or public safety. I'm not disputing that the police can't arrest somebody who shot a bunch of people in a subway station. Of course they can.
Yeah, and it seems to me that if we look at that, we're looking at there's kind of two categories, just general exigency, and then there's hot pursuit cases where,
yes,
you know, I observe Smith committing a crime, he gets away from me, I tell other officers Smith's driving a car, he's been identified, I observe the crime. And while they're in hot pursuit, someone can make that stop. And I think nobody's looking at that and says that's a problem. The question really, as I see it, is that once you've got, you know, thousands of these things that are months old, that there's no longer any pursuit, the probable cause may be stale. They may have been otherwise cleared, as is the case of at least one person here, right?
Yes.
I mean, at the end of the day, how long is long enough? And I guess that's not a question for you, but it seems to me that to whatever wanted posters have, whatever wanteds have in this sense, that at some point they have to have a sell-by date, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it seems like there's just, like, I mean, let me get back to this because I'm pontificating here. The real question is, how can it possibly be correct that somebody sitting in a neighborhood and they're an officer and they decide, I am going to now decide if there are any wanted for anyone who might be around this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That could be months old for reasons unexplained and that may have now been stale. What would be the exigent circumstances there? What would be the reason that would be appropriate, consistent with the warrant requirement?
It will surprise Your Honor not at all to hear that I think there is – you can't. I think that there is a difference between warrants, on the other hand, in that circumstance. A police officer driving through a neighborhood can look to see whether a judge has asked to have someone brought into court.
Now, if you've got probable cause, you try it in front of a neutral magistrate. They sign the warrant, no problem ever, right? I mean, we get that. But the real question is, what is this wanted? Well, I mean, what really is it? Which doesn't look like fish or fowl to me.
I agreed, Your Honor. The answer is what it is a desire to avoid doing legwork. There is no question that any one of these officers can go question the person. What they cannot do is say to someone else who is a police officer, I think I have a good enough reason. If you run into this person, bring him into custody, and then I'll come question them. No municipality allows that other than here. And the answer to that is it's an end run around the warrant requirement.
But isn't there something called the collective knowledge doctrine? And it allows an officer to basically attributes an officer's knowledge to other officers. And it arises in this context. And then you have Hensley, which I think is really a collective knowledge case. How do you deal with those cases and that general concept?
So let me take them, if I can, in that order. I don't know that Hensley is a collective knowledge
case. Okay, fair.
Let me separate them. What this court said in Robinson in the collective action or collective knowledge cases is, quote, when multiple officers are involved in an investigation. That is not what's happening here. Mr. Furlow was taken into custody because he didn't have plates on his car, and just because this is an inclarity in the record, he did. They were in the front window, not in the back, because in Illinois, when you get a new car, the plate's in the front. He was pulled over for not having a back license plate. It's a legitimate traffic stop, but he wasn't driving without plates. The person who is doing that knows nothing about Mr. Furlow or his domestic issues with his girlfriend. So there's no collective action at all. And I think in a roll call in a precinct in the morning, could one officer say to her colleague, I'm looking for this person? That's not this case. This case is the formalizing of orders by which officers with no collective knowledge then serve the warrant. As to Hensley, what's going on in Hensley is that the police issue a wanted bulletin that says, if you see Mr. Hensley, stop him and arrest him. And the holding of the court is, and one version of the bulletin implies there was a warrant, and that's a disputed issue in the case. What the Supreme Court holds is that that bulletin is reason enough to conduct a Terry stop. You can stop the person and say, who are you, and ask all the questions you're allowed that they don't have to answer. Hensley then goes on to say, we are not condoning the parts of the bulletin that would violate the Fourth Amendment. The only part of the bulletin they're not, what that means is the arrest him part. I should say, however, had there been probable cause in Hensley, I think Hensley would actually answer the question in this case and hold that the wanteds are unconstitutional. What they would be saying is one officer's assessment of probable cause is not enough to allow someone else.
Well, what's the difference between reasonable suspicion and probable cause? So they allow the stop for reasonable suspicion, but they do not. You're saying that probable cause is somehow different, even if the initial officer had probable cause. Not good enough if a later officer arrests.
I apologize, Your Honor. I didn't mean to say that. I said what I meant to finish with is that Hensley leaves that question open. But I think the difference, to answer Your Honor's question, is the difference between having an officer say, hey, I'd like to ask you some questions, and finding myself in custody. There's a seizure where I'm taken into court. That's the difference. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. Unless the court has questions, I'd like to reserve what I have left. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Counsel?
Yes. My name is Frank Smith. I'm an associate county counselor with St. Louis County Counselor's Office.
Can I start with where Judge Strauss just ended, this difference between a reasonable suspicion and probable cause? Seems to me that, in my mind, that the reasonable suspicion is that, you know, anything that you can reasonably articulate as suspicion that a crime is afoot, and that this person might be involved in that crime is just that, a reasonable suspicion. And on reasonable suspicion, an officer may make inquiry, reasonable inquiry. But I know of no reason that you can seize him, drive him to the courthouse or to the jail, hold him for up to 24 hours to talk to him. Can you do that based on reasonable suspicion under Terry?
I believe so. I think in this situation.
Does that happen routinely?
I think in this situation, what you had here was Mr. Furlow was pulled over for not having his tags viewable. And then the police officer ran his name and saw that there was a wanted for him. That wanted was based on probable cause that was found
out.
But
there's no warrant, right? So how do we know there's probable cause?
Well, based on the deposition testimony of the officers, you know, the issuance of...
But doesn't, in the real world, don't we get warrants? Because then before you get arrested, somebody's already decided there is a, you know, probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and you are the person who committed that crime? And this officer is not a magistrate.
Yes, but under Missouri law, a police officer can make a warrantless arrest if he has reasonable grounds to believe that a crime has been committed.
And so it's reasonable just because somebody else says so.
If they
I mean,
have
there's no real
cause.
Knowledge here. If you look at the collective knowledge doctrine, what you really have is three guys working the same case, and they've shared some information. Mm-hmm. And then they effectuate the rest. Collective knowledge may also be where you've given a direction to an officer who has a person in their sight, and then they are the agent of the person with knowledge. But in this case, you know, there's no agency relationship established. It's just a piece of paper filed months ago that says, yeah, we want to talk to him.
Yeah, but I don't see the distinction if that a judge had issued a warrant for that person's arrest.
Well, yeah, there's a distinction. One's issued by a neutral and detached magistrate, and the other one's is an investigating officer with skin in the game.
Yeah, but it's also but that investigative officer has based that on probable cause and based on St. Louis County's practice of issuing wanted.
Well, should
they
we
have
let
been
them
trained.
Allow them to just arrest anybody, anytime, any place? Why do we need magistrates at all?
Well, you know, if that specific jurisdiction decides to have a magistrate in order to do an independent evaluation of the evidence, that's fine. St. Louis County isn't the only jurisdiction to issue wanteds. You know, as I said before, the Missouri law allows police officers to make arrests without warrants.
They apparently have no end date, so they never become stale?
No, they do have end dates. They usually will expire in the system depending on the alleged transgression or alleged crime that was committed.
It's a pretty, you know, I think that one of the things about this is it's even if you're right constitutionally, it's a pretty risky proposition, which is to say that when you go to a neutral magistrate, you can invoke things like the good faith exception. You can obviously make the arrest because a magistrate told you you can make the arrest. When you're relying on a wanted, even if there is probable cause, the probable cause could be stale. The probable cause could be wrong. You have no access to the good faith exception. So at the very least, you would agree this is a pretty risky way to conduct business in the you know the state law enforcement community.
Yes, it has its downfalls as well. I think in situations that are at bar here, I think the issuance of wanteds for Mr. Furlow and Mr. Torres were adequate as far as trying to make sure that a crime was committed or not committed in order to see that justice had been served.
But I have a problem with Torres. I got to be honest with you. Furlow, less so. Torres, if you're going to – so collective knowledge actually extends to people in other agencies as well. And so one of the things that I'm confounded by is another agency says, oh, no, this was completely fabricated testimony by the daughter. That happened several weeks before that Clements made the arrest or whoever made the arrest. And so – don't we have a problem? Because collectively, even assuming Hensley and everything else, the probable cause was gone by that point.
Well, I think in that situation, you have to look at Detective Clement's subjective belief on whether or not there was probable cause. And I think in the situation that she was confounded with her telephone conversation with the mother of the child, as well as her viewing of the forensic interview of the child, I think she still believed that there was probable cause that a crime had been committed. However, I think, like you said, you know, it later came on that some of the allegations were fabricated. But I think under the qualified immunity doctrine, you have to look at whether or not her subjective belief was reasonable based on the information that she had before her.
No, I think that's fair. I think on qualified immunity grounds, that may be a way to go. But I think on the pure constitutional violation, I have a hard time saying we can ignore what the Department of Social Services knew when, in fact, in Missouri, and this is documented, those two are supposed to work together. The detective in the investigation, the detective and the caseworker are supposed to work together. So I don't think we can ignore what the caseworker knew.
And I think there were extraordinary circumstances at that time. I think Detective Clements would have done some more follow-up. But at that time, you had some of the disturbances due to the unrest with regards to some of the court's findings in other cases here and the disturbances in Ferguson, where Detective Clements had to go on 12-hour shifts in order to protect the community in those situations. I think in normal circumstances, she would have probably done some more follow-up with respect to the family of division services and things of that nature. But at the time, the extraordinary circumstances prevented her from doing that.
Counsel, can you clear up two things for me, please? Number one, is it true that the general order or the policy, the written policy that permits these wanted documents to be issued, does not require the existence of probable cause?
No. In order for a wanted to be issued by a San Luis County police officer, they must have determined that there has been probable cause.
For what? Probable cause?
Probable cause that a crime has been committed or is being committed in the eyes of the officer.
But not, well, the probable cause I'm talking about is probable cause to believe that the subject of the wanted committed the crime.
Yes. So like in this situation, and with Furlow, Officer Parton had probable cause based on his investigation and interviewing the victim of the assault and larceny, as well as a 16-year-old witness to the confrontation that Mr. Furlow had with his neighbor. And therefore, based on those statements, witness statements, and interviews and canvassing of the neighborhood, he came to the conclusion that there was probable cause that Mr. Furlow had assaulted and stole the cellular phone of his neighbor. With respect to Officer Walsh, as a result of his investigation, he had spoken with Mrs. Furlow based on her statements, emotional state, as well as a loaded AR-15 in the home. He had come to the conclusion that there was probable cause that Mr. Furlow had assaulted and battered his wife. And therefore, there was probable cause for domestic violence. If they had not reached that conclusion, they would not have issued the wanted.
Well, what step is saved? I mean, if there's probable cause, why not? I guess I'm asking, what's the purpose of this policy if it requires probable cause that the subject has committed a crime? I mean, why not take it before a judge?
Well, I think in a perfect world, that probably would be the best thing to do. That probably would be a best practice. I think that falls short from the practice being unconstitutional.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, let's think about this for a minute. There's no exigent circumstances since they're hanging around for months and nobody's acting on them. There's no description in the wanted as to what the probable cause is. I mean, you could solve this problem if you just said, we believe A, B, C, D are true, all tend to point towards the fact that this person has committed a crime. We believe there's probable cause, arrest them for that. Then at least the arresting officer has some reason to believe that they know what's going on. I mean, all they know now is that arrest Smith, Smith's committed the crime of domestic violence. That's all they know. And so, you know, they can't tell the guy anything when they arrest him. They can't give any reasonable information to the person's lawyer if they have one who contacts them. It's just nothing. And it looks to me like in reading the record, reading the briefs, that the only reason this exists is because the prosecutor said, oh, I just don't want to get probable cause established in warrants until I've had a chance to interview the person and hear both sides of the story. Well, I mean, you're inconveniencing somebody by arresting them, dragging them off, holding them for up to a day, just so the prosecutor can't do their job, figure out whether or not there's probable cause, and talk to a neutral magistrate.
I understand the Your Honor's your point of view on that. I guess I think that still falls short of being it unconstitutional.
Why?
Especially pursuant to Missouri law, which states that the police officer can make an arrest without a warrant if they believe that the offender had violated an ordinance or crime or statute.
Well, so, you know, but what basis does the guy? I mean, I get if this is the person who took the original complaint and issued the wanted and they arrest them because they have knowledge. You know, what real reason What reasonable basis does the officer have to believe that there actually is probable cause when there's no description of it other than arrest Smith for domestic violence?
Well, I think there's a little bit more information in the warrants than just arrest X, Y, or Z because of this. I think, you know, in order for the warrants to even be issued, I think you have to go through a certain, the St. Louis County police officers go through certain steps in order to make sure.
Yeah, they go through steps, the supervisor does it, then they tell the dispatcher, right?
Yeah.
But you still have somebody on the street arresting people with absolutely no knowledge of what happened other than they said arrest Smith.
And that's what I said earlier. I think in that situation, if you put yourself in the shoes of that arresting officer, there isn't much difference from...
But the Constitution doesn't protect the arresting officer. It's like the warrant requirement protects the person who's having their body seized.
I understand that. But I think, as you said, in the arresting officer not having knowledge, I think that's why I said there's a slight distinction. I don't see that much of a distinction between that and a warrant being issued by a magistrate judge. If a police officer pulls somebody over for expired tags and they run the person's name through the computer system and they find out there's a wanted for this person, I mean a warrant for arrest, they don't know all the backgrounds that go
what
on with them, but they make the arrest.
There's a warrant signed by a neutral magistrate, not something decided by a police officer who, you know, the public may not really trust all that much.
I understand that, but also that police officer knows that if this wanted has been issued, it's been issued based on probable cause.
Do we know that? And I want to get back to Judge Shepard's question because it concerns me. You heard opposing counsel say this is investigative as well. So suppose you have a witness, right, who sees a bank robbery. And would there ever be an occasion under Missouri law where a wanted could be issued for an eyewitness to a crime rather than the person who committed the bank robbery, for example?
No, because unless there was probable cause that the eyewitness was also part of the crime, no. You have to have probable cause that a crime has been committed before they want to commit.
By that person?
Yes, by that person. By that eyewitness would not have a wanted issued for their arrest because there would be no probable cause that he or she committed the crime of robbery. So I think that's really the bottom line here is these aren't just... Okay, the police officers, we want to talk to this person, and they have, you know, either asserted their right to counsel or they refuse to be talked. So we're going to go ahead and issue a wanted to get them in our custody so we can interview them. No, probable cause has already been established. If you can see in these situations, the officers wanted to talk to Mr. Furlow and Mr. Torres to get their side of the story because all they have is allegations that they committed these crimes. And they did not do that. And so they had probable cause at that point to issue a wanted for arrest. As in the first instance with Mr. Furlow, as soon as he was taken into custody, he was issued a summons for assault and larceny. The second time, he was released right around 24 hours because it was a domestic violence situation, which the Missouri Supreme Court has held that you in accordance with the Missouri law that you shall discharge an arrestee of a warrantless arrest within 24 hours has shown that you can hold them up to that in certain situations, which domestic violence would be part of those exceptions. I see that my time is up. I would just ask the court to hereby affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment to the appellees on counts 1, 2, and 3 of the appellant's First Amendment complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, go ahead and take 3 minutes to conclude.
I appreciate that. Let me start by addressing the Missouri law that my friend cited about the right of an officer to arrest. What that statute says is that an officer may arrest on view a suspect whom the officer has probable cause to believe has committed a crime or has witnessed committing a crime. It begins with the words on view. It's exactly what's wrong with the wanted system. The officers who arrested Mr. Furlow while driving his car and Mr. Liner and Mr. Torres didn't have probable cause to arrest the person on view. Someone else did that. That's what's wrong. Judge Erickson, you asked the question of whether you can arrest someone on a Terry stop. The answer is no. You also made the comment, and forgive me, that you're inconveniencing the person by taking them into custody. You certainly are, but I want to make an additional point. Every single person whom this court has ever interviewed to be a law clerk, me when I was a law clerk, were asked, have you ever been arrested? Being arrested is not only an inconvenience, you're right, it's a life-changing event. There is a reason we require arrest warrants before we take somebody into custody. Judge Shepard, you asked whether the policy requires probable cause. It does now. It was amended in 2015. It is the position of the county that it has always required that. They just forgot to write it down. But as of 2015, those words are in the policy.
Is it, I think counsel said that this is not specific to St. Louis and that other municipalities or governmental entities in elsewhere in Missouri utilize a similar policy. Is that your understanding?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a little bit, convenient. The county of St. Louis, the city of St. Louis, the municipality of Ferguson, a number of the municipalities in this localized area do it. But I think it is interesting that the policy itself, and just for the court's convenience, the policy in its current version is at page A37 to 41 of the record.
Is there state law that authorizes this?
We contend there is not. The only state law they've ever cited is that an officer may arrest on view and that you can't hold someone for more than 24 hours. Neither of those authorizes this. And in fact, you can't enter a wanted into the statewide MULES system or into the national NCIC system unless it is for less than 24 hours and it's an emergency, precisely because other jurisdictions won't serve these, which I think says something about the constitutionality of them. Recognizing I'm out of time, I want to make another quick point. Judge Strass, you're exactly right. Even if Officer Clements were individually immune, that doesn't change the fact that the policy is unconstitutional. And in holding that immunity of the individual defendants would eclipse Monell liability, the district court simply flat out erred in light of this court's holding in Webb.
On that point, don't we have to conclude, because that's a facial challenge, don't we have to conclude that the policy is unconstitutional in all of its applications?
I think the policy is unconstitutional in all of
its
applications.
That's fair.
But I do think if the court were to find that the individual class members, there might have been probable cause for one, two, or perhaps even three of them, I think that's a question that goes to the merits of the trial we need to have. It's not a reason to affirm. The district court's conclusion was that if the individual officers are immune, there can be no Monell liability. That is simply wrong as a matter of law. And then finally, I heard a request to affirm as to count three. Count three was never litigated below. Entry of summary judgment on count three was also an error of law. And then I have one more finally. I think I heard my adversary to say that it would be best practice if a municipality chose to have magistrates review probable cause determinations. With the greatest respect, it's not best practices, it's the Fourth Amendment. We left England. You have a right to have a magistrate judge decide whether there is probable cause to have you arrested. And with that, I'm out of time, and I'm grateful to Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will render a decision in due course.
Thank you.
Please call our next case.